Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hope everybody's doing well today. I want to welcome everybody to the Unimpressed Podcast today. And today we have a very special guest on the show. His name is John Ilsley. And I think I'm saying that right based on how he told me to say it. You might know him from a little band called Dire Straits. So welcome, John. How are you doing today?
I'm pretty good. It's a bit nippy here in England, I have to say. I've just got back from Mexico. So the drop in temperature was quite serious, I must say. We had a frost this morning on the ground. And anyway, there we are. I'm very well. Thank you.
What's going on with you right now as far as your music and so forth? And we'll dive deep and kind of, you know, what led you down this path and this journey?
I'm still completely not obsessed, but fascinated about trying to write a good song. I still have a desire to communicate with the outside world through music and verse. So I'm constantly trying to find something interesting for me initially, then hopefully for somebody else after that. So it's a drive, but it's just a gentle drive. You know, I mean, I got up early this morning because I was jet lagged and, you know, sat in the kitchen with a cup of tea and a guitar and, you know, hit out a few little ideas, which I'm on the iPhone. And so the jigsaw puzzle starts, you know, and it's quite interesting how things come together, I find, these days.
Now, do you feel like after having such a great career, do you somewhat forget about that, you know, and just every day's a new day when you have that passion?
I've put it into some kind of perspective, because it was quite an extreme experience, I must say. Funnily enough, when you're actually going through it, it seems, I know it sounds crazy, it seems kind of normal. You know, the way the band was operating, and we were very fortunate and the band was successful. And that opens up a lot of possibilities with music and with how you change your music, develop your music. And so you have to put it in perspective, because we stopped touring and making music in 1992, which is actually 30 years ago. But I'm constantly reminded of it because, well, modern day communications, the internet and such like. And I get really, generally speaking, a lot of very positive things from people all over the world, which I think is what the wonderful thing about the internet is, that we can communicate. These are the good things about the internet. There's lots of things that aren't so good, but yes, the good things about it are the fact that it's a wonderful communication tool. So I get to talk to people and communicate with people who have just discovered Dire Straits, you know, like a 17-year-old kid in Shanghai or something, you know, or in India. Somebody wrote to me in India the other day. I think he was a 19-year-old kid who just started playing the guitar and discovered Salt to Swing and things like that, which is kind of a gentle reminder about, you know, having left a bit of a legacy behind, which is always, it's a good feeling. It's not a bad feeling. It's a very good feeling. And I felt very honored to be part of that story, if you like, the Dire Straits story. Working with Mark was a privilege and a pleasure.
When you listen to some of your music outside of some of the songs that you're not, you know, that people know, did you ever think this was like a somewhat of a spiritual journey in a way? Because your sound was very, very worldly, you know, in a way, a very, you know, I don't know how to describe it, but it's a somewhat of a different tone than what you would normally hear.
I mean, I think that we were a little bit surprised about how it became a global phenomena, actually. If everybody could figure that out, then, you know, everybody would be selling lots of records and having lots of success. But it's a bit of a mystery, I think. And as long as it remains a mystery, I think that's rather interesting. But I mean, the English language is a great way, part, a great part of the music scene. It actually, a lot of people learn the English language through song. But I think that some people have the ability, and I'm saying this about Mark, really, some people have the ability to write a song which communicates on several different levels, which it's an easy thing to say, but a difficult thing to do. And if you asked him the same question, he'd probably say, I have no idea.
If you broke that down and put that in a perspective of vibrations, you know, because I think there's certain talents, you know, out in the world that are able to express themselves with different types of vibrations, and certain vibrations can hit, you know, resonate, or, you know, certain vibrations will resonate with multiples of people. You know, it's all about, you know, relatability. Did you ever think about projecting those type of vibrations?
Well, that's probably quite a good way of describing it, but I don't know whether we're no more worldly than a lot of other people. I just think that some things just capture people's imagination. I think the ability to communicate through song is a great talent, if you like, which is why I, as I said to you earlier, I spend a lot of time, you know, trying to, you know, I've got 8 solo albums now, so I've had plenty of practice at writing and I enjoy the process, but you don't really know how it's going to be absorbed by people. And I think that's where, but your idea of resonance, I think, is quite a good way of describing it. Some things resonate, some things don't. I mean, we know the bands that resonate around the world, you know, your Fleetwood Macs, your Eagles, your Who's, your Rolling Stones, the Beatles, particularly, you know, AC/DC on a different kind of level. I mean, there are some bands that just manage to communicate on a bigger scale. Coldplay is having a great time of it right now. U2 had wonderful moments, and we can pick them. You know, there's sort of a dozen, say, seriously major bands that have influenced music on a fairly big scale. And your word resonance, I think, is a very good way of describing it. It resonates with other people, whether they're in India, Africa, or New Zealand. You know, it's not just about America and the UK, although, to be honest, that's where most of the music's always come from, America and the UK. I think as long as it remains a bit of a mystery, you know, that's what sort of so entices us into the possibility of keeping going. I mean, I don't really need to do anything else, but I do enjoy the process. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think it's a drive, right? It's an internal drive. And certain people, I think certain artists realize at a certain time in their life, this internal drive is going to be there regardless. And
yeah. Yeah.
That makes sense.
I think that some people just communicate differently. I'm better at communicating with, I mean, I do paint a lot. I don't know whether you know this. It's the other thing that I do is I paint, which is a very different form of communication. I paint abstract paintings, you know, with a bit of a, you know, whatever, you have to decide for yourself what you think of them. But, you know, it's a way I communicate without using words and without using music. So I have both those things going for me. I was in the studio today trying to figure something out. You know, so I have a daily sort of process with art and music. Sometimes it's all art, sometimes it's music, and sometimes it's neither. But I think they're wonderful communication tools. And, you know, when I hear politicians trying to communicate with us, they do it on such a narrow band, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't move people. It's just sort of, they're preaching in a sense, in some sort of way. And often not very effectively, whereas music is an emotional thing. And I think it excites people. It does something to our endorphins and makes us feel good. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And all sorts of different types of music make people feel differently. My daughter is she's 24 years old. And she said, Dad, you've got to listen to Taylor Swift. And I think she's just wonderful. You know, she's a fantastic communicator.
I think there's only a few in this day and time. Because if you think about some of your time, you know, of communicating, things were a lot simpler. You know, things were more clear. And tone always works. I think when you realize tone always works, and you can see, you know, the younger generations gravitating to, you know, clear, simple music, they're going back to your time.
Well, in some ways, you know, when I first started listening to music, I went back as well. I was, I think, 14 when the Beatles were 15 or something, when the Beatles hit the headlines and the Stones and stuff. But then I went back and found out where they'd found their ideas from, which was the old blues stuff and gospel and all the rest of it. So I think everybody, if they're interested in music, you know, you look back as well, because it forms the shape of where you are now, and everything that's happening now has come from somewhere else.
Because I think technology has somewhat created too many choices. And I think you said something about politicians, you know, those politicians are trying to play to the population, which is very, very diluted, if you will. Does that make sense?
Diluted, that's a good word. Got
it. There's a lot of choices out there. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, you don't really know where to find good music. And like, I think there's got to be a rebirth or a reset to make people understand that. You know, because they're, you know, kids don't know what to choose or what direction to go into.
You have to have your own filters. I think you have to filter out the stuff that, you know, I listen to things that, again, that's definitely not for me. I like words and I like music with words. I don't like purely electronic music. It's not something I would sit and listen to, but I know it's a big deal. Big people, you get a whole crowd of 30,000 people jumping up and down with their arms in the air because the guy on the stage is jumping around with his arms in the air. There's no vocals. It's just literally a form of energy, a form of communicating energy. So that you go back to what you said, there's so much stuff out there, a lot of stuff. I don't know how many tracks are loaded onto Spotify every day, but it's a colossal amount of music. You just physically.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Mentally don't have the time to filter all that out. So, I mean, it's easy for me because I'm a sucker for singer-songwriters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm very happy with Dylan, Leonard Cohen, Van Morrison, you know, the Byrds, you know, I mean, I just like good songs. For me, it's the dead simple. So that really pushes me away from an awful lot of stuff that I don't have the time. I just don't physically have the time to listen to it. So if one of my kids says to me, I mean, my son is a DJ and he works with electronic music and so on. He plays something to me and it was actually fascinating. I ended up listening to the bass line actually, because it was a great, it wasn't a bass guitar. It was a keyboard bass, but I loved what he was doing. This guy was doing with this bass. And I thought, well, I'm going to nick a few of those ideas. There's too much of everything really. I mean, this is the world we live in. And going back to the politicians, I feel quite sorry for them because actually trying to get through to people seems to be increasingly more difficult because people are so wary about what people are saying and they just kind of don't believe any of it anymore, which is a shame because when I was growing up, I felt that politicians, they were more statesmanlike. You know, they were doing it for a different kind of reason than they are now.
When you think about people now, it's an identity-driven world, and they, yes, to some extent, they are placating to,
yeah,
that.
Exactly.
You know, and going back to choices, and I'm about focused energy, and a lot of people don't realize it. Like, you know, when y'all made an album and how focused you were, and, you know, the production on one song, I mean, what, yeah, was the budget? I mean, now the production on one song, you can make a song for $2,000. What was, you know what I'm saying? What was the focus and what was the budget on one song? You know, I think there's something to that.
I think that's a good point. I mean, we did address the albums as each individual piece of work. So, you know, it's quite old fashioned now to think about putting a record on, you know, a vinyl on the record player. And so you thought very carefully about how you started the record, what finished the first side before you flipped it over. And the idea was that you made a piece of music that people would sit down and listen to the whole thing. They wouldn't just take one track off it or whatever. That's all changed now. So, but I mean, I'm still very traditional. I still make my albums like I want somebody to put it on at the beginning and run it through to the end. Mm-hmm. So I think very carefully, and the Straits thought very carefully about how we, you know, constructed the albums. And you're right. We spend a lot of time on some of the, I mean, for instance, Telegraph Road, take that as an example. That was a difficult thing to get together because it's, you know, actually playing live, it was easy because it just has this. But when you're trying to record it, it's a different kind of thing. I mean, 14 minutes is quite a, you know, quite a thing to keep that level of energy right. And so, yeah, I mean, if you analyzed every track, what you spent on every track, I mean, you'd be, you'd probably think, oh my God, you wouldn't do that now. But mm-hmm. yeah, I still do it now because I just love the process of recording with proper musicians in the room. Difficult with COVID, of course it was, but you know, we got around it. So I think there's a traditional approach to it, but there's lots of other approaches to it. I mean, but you can make an album on what I'm talking to you through now on a laptop. I mean, I don't know how to do it, but people do. I mean, they make it in their living rooms and it seems to sound completely fine.
Funny you say this, because this is what I recognize. I manage a country artist who is on The Voice. His name is Avery Robertson. And uh-huh. and a lot of these young kids, like when you came up with an initial idea for a song and you laid the song down, I know there's excitement with that initial idea. You know, how many times did you go back to that song to perfect it? Because I think a lot of times these kids will take an initial idea, get excited and want to get the music out there too quickly. Before they let it, that before they digest it, look at it again, go back in, digest more, look at it again to perfect it. Because the anxiety that is created with social media and technology, they yeah. want to get it out there. They want to get it out there. Like, how many times did you go back to a song to perfect it?
Quite a lot, actually, I would say. Although some songs were just easier to get to where you wanted to get to. Romeo and Juliet, for instance, was just the most beautiful kind of simplicity in a way. It was just a question of getting the right feeling on that one. But the first time that Mark played it to me on his national, he came around to the house and said, I've written this thing. I think it's okay. And I said, it's more than okay. it's kind of, you've written it already. I mean, all we're going to do is just add a few bass notes and a bit of drums on it and it's done. But then, of course, it's more than that, obviously. But I mean, each song is approached with the intention of trying to get the best out of it. And sometimes there are several different versions and some I've completely forgotten. I mean, the original version of Sultans that we had was like slightly country sort of thing. You know, I think the chords were similar, but it had that country feel to it. And it's only when the Red Stratocaster arrived that suddenly we got where we are now with Sultans. So each song has its own sense of discovery in a way. Just to go back to Telegraph Road, for instance, I mean, we actually rehearsed the songs for Love Over Gold while we were on tour doing the Making Movies tour in 1980, 81. We used the sound checks for actually working out all the different passages and song and tunes and stuff, because we, you know, sound checks are very boring. So we thought we'd work on the new album while we were touring on the last one. So when we got back home to go and record Love Over Gold in New York at the Power Station, it was easier. But having said that, Private Investigations was a tricky one. Mm-hmm. That was a tricky one to get that right.
How did Money for Nothing, how did that come about? I mean, I know that's one you probably hate hearing about. You're like, but you know, I got to ask you about Money for Nothing. You're probably like, damn, I don't want to talk about that song. I hear it all the time. How did that happen?
Initially, Mark had moved to New York with his wife, Lourdes, and they'd bought a house in Manhattan, in the Village, I think. And I think you have to imagine Mark going into a white goods store and looking at refrigerators and televisions and stuff like that, which of course is a very interesting thought. But he was in this store trying to buy some, bits of kit for the house, you know, because he needed TVs and washing machines and dishwashers and stuff like that. So he was in the store and he walked into a room where there was, this is the early days of MTV. There was literally a wall of TV screens all on MTV. So he started watching this and suddenly overheard some of the guys in the store talking about what was on the screen. And I'm not sure who the artist was on the screen, but they were saying things like, that ain't working. That's the way you do it. That's money for nothing. That, I mean, these guys, they get all the girls, you know, they're chicks for nothing and chicks for free and blah, blah, blah. And Mark was standing behind the refrigerator, sort of writing all these little ideas down for this song. And then suddenly appeared and he said, I've got this, I've got this song called Money for Nothing. But the guitar lick obviously came later. And in fact, the sound of the guitar was an accident as well, because we were in Montserrat when we recorded the Brothers in Arms album in Montserrat. At the end of a session, somebody knocked over one of the microphones in front of one of Mark's amps. And Mark was just mucking about, you know, playing the riff and all the rest of it, trying to get the sound. And somebody knocked the microphone over by mistake. And suddenly there was a yell from the control room. They said, "That's it. That's the sound." And we said, "Well, the microphone's lying on the floor." He said, "I don't care where it is. That is the sound, right? That's the sound we want on this track." And we went into the control room, and it was absolutely spot on. So that's, you know, these accidents happen. And, of course, Omar Hakim, who you probably know, used to play with Sting in his band, the drummer, he came over and he did all the drum work on that, which was a great pleasure playing with him. But, you know, it's how things come about. Sometimes by accident, it's what I'm talking about is really observation. I mean, Mark observing those guys talking about MTV, you know, we hadn't got MTV over in the UK by then. It came a bit later, but this was just listening to people talking about, you know, what was going on. And the thing about songwriters is they pick up on things that other people don't pick up on. They hear things and they go, "Oh, that's a good idea for a song."
What's your foundation, you know, with that, with your projection and somewhat of a, I guess the sound would be called Celtic. I mean, mom and dad, were they artists? Was any people in the family artists? You know, where did this come from?
Well, my parents were not musical and they weren't artists. My father was a local bank manager in the middle of England in Leicestershire. He'd got back from the war, and essentially, like a lot of people who just got back from the war, he wanted his family to be safe. So he was intent on creating a world around us, which was a safe world. And in fact, actually, I wrote a song about it, actually, which is on the new album, which is called Eight, and it's called Market Town. And it's really, that will give you an idea about what life was like in those days. But it was a very safe world, you know. They'd come through, and of course in the 50s everybody was on rationing and all that kind of stuff. I don't know whether you had that in America. You probably didn't. But so I grew up in a very comfortable environment, but then I discovered music. And that completely turned me upside down. I heard Chuck Berry, I think, through a very small crystal radio set, you know, some wayward radio station was playing American music, Chuck Berry. And then I heard Elvis and I thought, "Oh my God, what's going on out there?" It just completely flipped me out. And I thought, I gotta have some of this. I don't know what it was. And I said, I just said to my dad, "I need a guitar." And he said, "What do you mean you need a guitar?" And I said, "I don't know. I need a guitar. I want to play a guitar." And so I saved up my pocket money for weeks and weeks on end and bought the cheapest thing from the local shop, which was a horrible thing to play. And that was it. That just got me going. So I think that what it was, I was in a very safe house, but there wasn't enough emotional contact with the world, and I needed something more than that safe world. And so ever since that moment, I've sort of taken the other path rather than the safe path, if you like, which is probably why I ended up being a musician. And I still do that now. I still take the unpredictable path because, you know, it's unpredictable, and I like that. So I don't know whether I've given that to my children or not. I have no idea, but they'll probably surprise me at some point.
Do you feel like you're a highly sensitive person?
Oh, gosh, that's a very personal question to ask.
You know, because the reason I asked, true artist, you know, if you picked up the guitar, I would imagine it didn't take you long to catch on based on my read. And I think that comes from, you know, great artists are highly sensitive people. So I don't think it's a bad thing or anything. I think it just tells the story a little more about who you truly are in a way, you know?
Well, it goes back to that, you know, that excitement about hearing, you know, rock and roll, Elvis and Chuck Berry and the Beatles and the Stones, hearing all that and just feeling something inside. So I suppose it turned something on in me, some sensitivity to that kind of music. And so I was kind of, from that point on, I just remember being determined to be part of this world. And I didn't quite know in what capacity, because before the Straits started, I'd played in 7-8 different bands, blues bands, folk bands, jazz bands, even, for God's sake. You know, I just loved playing music, especially playing with other people. And I think that's the core. Doing things on your own is fine. You have to do things on your own because you have to practice and you have to work things out. But playing with other people is still the greatest pleasure. And I love playing live. I love doing gigs, even if they're small gigs. I don't care whether it's big or small. It doesn't matter. I don't care. It can be anything. Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I think it satisfies my sense of myself, if you like, how I think about the world and how I feel in the world.
The only reason I say that, just to give you a little background about myself, I'm a clairsentient and I'm somewhat of a reluctant shaman. I have very high sensitivities myself, and I've been going through this, like, unearthing all this, you know, in the past 5-10 years. Uh-huh. So it's just, you know, a lot of these thoughts go through my head that are very intriguing that I didn't have in my 20s and 30s, you know. So when you have these gifts show up in your life, you start to look at human beings a little different. Uh-huh. That's the only reason I asked that question. I think there's a big difference between a true artist and an artist who's trying to be an artist.
Yeah, sometimes it's difficult to tell the difference, but you're probably quite intuitive then. I mean, obviously you've got a natural intuition towards, you know, measuring people or working people out. I mean, I've got a lot of artist friends, you know, especially painters, actually, funnily enough, and they're a different kind of person than anybody else. Most people who paint don't actually sell their paintings. I've discovered there's an awful lot of paintings sitting around in people's places, which are never going to leave that place. But there's something about the sensitivity towards the world, I suppose, is what I'm thinking of, and how you deal with the world, because especially now, there's more distractions. When I was growing up, there were very few distractions. So, you know, there wasn't much television to watch. There was no internet. There was no phones. There was no nothing. It was basically, oh, great, I found the guitar. This is going to be my modus operandi. And then I discovered the bass, which, of course, you know, is really my instrument. That's how I know how to play a song, is through the bass, if you like.
And I'm sure that resonated to your success. When you recognize that, you're like, that's what I'm the best in the world at.
Yeah, I just felt, I just, as soon as I picked it up, even though I didn't want to, because I wanted to join the band as a guitar player, the first band, and they said, mm-hmm. No, you can't, you've got to play the bass. And I said, I don't have a bass. And and my brother William, who he was very good at making things, he made me one. It looked like a spade. Somehow or other, he made me a bass, and that was my first guitar. And I suddenly thought, this is me. Uh-huh. This is where I fit in to this world.
Gotcha.
And I think that I was able, when Mark and I got together, to recognize where I needed to be in that place. You know, he and I immediately sort of made sense together musically, because we'd obviously been listening to the same, because we're exactly the same age, we've been listening to the same kinds of music all over these years. And so, you know, as soon as he picked up the guitar and started playing, I just joined in on the bass, and it was like, oh, that's the way it should be. You know, mm-hmm. it was wonderfully obvious in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think as soon as that happened, I knew that Dire Straits was going to be something different. No idea it was going to do what it did, but I knew it was going to be something worthy, if you like.
We'll bring this to a close and we'll talk about the book, but I have one more question about, like, the foundation in your environment. It's a Celtic, like, worldly sound. Is that environmentally, does that come from, you know, from the area, from England? Where did those roots, you think, came from?
Well, the Celtic roots.
Yes. Sound, like, what would you classify the worldly sound of some of those songs that may not have been the most famous ones? What would you classify? Is that a Celtic? Where does that come from?
I think it just comes from so many different sources. I think we can go back to where we were talking about half an hour ago, how that thread managed to sort of communicate with a lot of different places in the world. The Celtic thing is definitely part of it, but I think it's more to do with each song needing its own particular treatment, its own a world, if you like. And so each song was dealt with individually. I think because we were of a certain age, Mark and I, we were 26 when we met. And we'd both been listening to the same kind of folk music, country music, rock and roll music, jazz, black music, reggae. We'd been listening to all that kind of stuff. So that feeds into you and you don't really forget any of it. It just comes out when necessary to make that particular song, whatever it is, come alive.
Gotcha.
If that makes any sense. Yeah.
Well, I know you have a book out there and some other things. Tell us a little bit about that and where do we find anything John Ilsley?
Well, there's quite a bit of John Ilsley stuff out there, it turns out.
I'm having eight, hard to find you, right?
as I say, I've got eight solo albums, so there's quite a bit of music out there. This last album seems to, number eight, seems to have been the most successful, which has been very pleasing. And I'm getting feedback from all over the world on this one, so which is good. And then what happens is you have a successful album, then people go look back at your other ones. So everything seems to have picked up a lot over the last year, actually, with all the albums, all the songs. And then the book. Well, I was approached by a lady at a charity function. I didn't realize who she was, but I was sitting next to a literary agent, and she'd been to see one of the shows I was doing, which was called The Life and Times of Dire Straits, which was me talking to one of my ex-managers and chatting about the whole history of the band and then playing songs in association with that particular period of time. So it was like a sort of a chat and music, you know, it was music and talk. And she came to see the show and she sat next to me at this charity supper. And she said, you should write a book. And I said, what do you mean write a book? She said, well, I'm a literary agent. I said, I think I can get you a book deal. And I said, oh my God, no, I can write songs, but I'm not sure about writing a book. I said, I need some help with that. But anyway, one thing led to another and I agreed to go and talk to her and she got me a contract with Penguin, a Trans World, which was pretty good. So a friend of mine who I've known for many years, who's a professional ghostwriter, who knew nothing about music, this chap, I said, look, I've been offered this book deal, but I can write, but I can't write a book. I've got all the ideas in my head. I can remember amazingly quite a lot of the stuff we did. Will you help me put it together? And so we did this thing together and I was very pleased with the result because as I said to you, he didn't know anything about music. So I had to literally teach him about what it was like to be in a band and how it works and how you make records and how you do gigs and all the rest of it. And so he had a certain naivety about it. And yeah, I mean, it's certainly out in America. I think it's out on Division Books or something. I don't know the company, but it's actually done quite well, which is quite pleasing. Like, you're always a bit frightened when you put out something that is not what you normally do.
And the name of that book is, I'll just let everybody know, if the book John is talking about is My Life in Dire Straits.
Well, the thing is, you know, for me, John, it was really a celebration more than anything else. It was a celebration of the story that I was involved in and all the people, especially Mark, you know, and all the people involved, Mark and the crew and the caterers and the lighting guys and the truck drivers and the other band members, wonderful musicians we had over the years. I mean, we got to play with some great people. We got to play in some fantastic places. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And I wanted to, that's why I wanted to put it down, actually, to make people really think about what it was like to be in that situation and the joy not only it gave me, but hopefully gave an awful lot of other people. As I said, it's a celebration to me of, you know, having had a very, very good life and still being here to tell the tale.
Has anybody approached you about a film?
I can't imagine how that would work. I mean, the Queen film was remarkable in how it worked. I mean, it worked very well.
It would have to be an awesome movie, I would think.
Well, it would be, but I mean, it's making records, doing gigs, you know, divorces, marriages, children, you know, all sorts of stuff on the road, which we don't talk about. You know, just a sort of a, you know, I don't know. Nobody's even asked the question yet. So,
well, John, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. It's very easy to talk to you. And hopefully people can listen to this and learn something about life and humanity and what it's like being an artist. But yes, I appreciate you coming on the show. And it was fun. This is Mr. John Ilsley. And I am John Edmonds Cosma, the CEO of Bang Productions. Mm-hmm.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.